For the week of September 28th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 251, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the office, answering the phone number of 212-555-4200, I'm Michael Gills.
What is that the phone number to?
That's the Equalizer. Odds against you? Need help? Call the Equalizer. 212-555-4200. A classic fake number.
Yes, mainly because it begins with 555.
Exactly.
Yes, you know, I actually saw clips of that, like sequences of that film, starring Denzel Washington in CinemaCon. I almost said Comic-Con. At CinemaCon, and it looked pretty interesting. It then gets released over this past weekend, does quite well. It does not get very good reviews, though.
Well, it's, you know, it's more of a commercial film, I guess.
Yes, I don't know. I mean,
they weren't shooting for Oscars. They were shooting for fun.
Well, apparently in that film, they're shooting quite a lot.
Well, it is a little more violent than The Show, I believe. You know, The Show starred Edward Woodward. It was a TV series on CBS, I think. I'm almost certain. Yes, it was CBS. So I think the movie does notch up the violence quotient a little bit. Stars Denzel Washington. And we'll be getting to that shortly. What else will we be talking about this week?
Well, before I tell you what we are going
to... Oh, it's a secret.
Well, that's not a secret. I just wanted to let everybody know that they could email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail about anything you hear on the show. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, I also see that you've marked here in our show notes that it's not the ego, but the id. It's Idris Elba.
That's the latest word on how to remember to pronounce the name of the very fine actor Idris Elba. It's
Idris
not
Elba.
The ego, but the id. Idris Elba.
Okay.
Well, I'll try to remember, subsume my ego, and get his name right. Mr. Elba, frankly, is what I'm going to stick to.
Okay. Well, I don't know if we'll be talking about Idris Elba. Idris Elba.
I just
moments ago, we talked about this. Idris, I don't know if we're going to talk about him today, but on this week's show... It will be just you and I, Michael, no special guest, because we have a lot to talk about. First off, there was some surprise news over the weekend that the Japanese conglomerate SoftBank had made an offer to buy DreamWorks Animation. So we'll have to give you the rundown on all the details and what it all means. Satellite radio provider Sirius XM lost a huge court case last week, and the court case was over the public performance of pre-1972 sound recordings. Sounds complicated, but we'll explain. What it means, at least initially, is an appeal, first of all, because, you know, that's not going to stand. But it also might mean that Sirius XM owes hundreds of millions of dollars to rights holders. The case has huge copyright implications, not just for Sirius XM, but also to streaming radio services like Pandora. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're talking about box office around the world, not just North America. We get our information from Rentrak. We have a link to their website in our show notes. We also pull info from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, anywhere it arises. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, The Equalizer, starring Denzel Washington. It's a spinoff from the TV show. It grossed $52 million worldwide. It's the number one movie in North America. It did much better than it's tracking, as we've seen so much lately. And the big story here is, as it has been for the past 15 years at least, Denzel Washington opens movies. The guy is a star. If you put him in a movie, he's almost always going to give you at least $20 to $25 million. And if everything clicks better, you're going to do something like $35 million.
Yes, and I think that's true overseas as well. In other words, he opens movies not just in the U.S. and Canada, but in Asia and in Europe and in Russia, etc.
Well, he does get his movies released overseas, which is more than almost any other black actor can say, unfortunately, because Hollywood leaves money on the table. I don't know why, but they do. And he does get his movies shown overseas. They do open up. You know, if you look at the movies around the world and their budget, they're not always tearing it up. I mean, Two Guns was his last movie. That cost $61 million to make. and that only grossed $132 million worldwide. When all is said and done, they probably made money on it, but that's certainly not a big hit. You want to triple your budget, I think, worldwide. But that did make $75 million domestic, which means it made about $60 million overseas. So yeah, he made about the same money overseas that he did domestically. Same thing with Flight. That drama that made $90 million in North America and another $70 million overseas. The fact that you can open him overseas at all is a real testament to his worldwide power. He and Will Smith and one or two others are really, you know, truly big movie stars. But I think the big story there is just he opens movies.
Yes.
No matter where you end up, the guy's going to bring people in on the opening weekend. So that is, you know, money in the bank as far as studios are concerned. At number two around the world is The Maze Runner. This is that dystopian young adult novel turned into the first of a series. It grossed $45 million. It's at $150 million worldwide. I saw it, and it's not good.
You know, so it would have been better if you saw it in Barco Escape.
That's right. It would have been. If only The Maze had been wider. However, my friend Zoe did like it a little bit better than me, and she calls it Boys in a Box. Instead of The Maze Runner, she thinks, let's go see Boys in the Box.
That's actually a very funny title for that movie.
I think it's the porn title, but anyway. And number three around the world is The Box Trolls. This is the animated film from the producers behind Coraline and Paranorman, right?
Yes.
Yes. And it's not getting good reviews. It had a weak opening in North America, but it has grossed $22 million. It's at $35 million worldwide. At number four is our first new film on the list that's overseas, not in North America only. That's Dearest. It's a Chinese film. It made $13 million, and it cost about $12 million to make, so that's a great start. And it's directed by Peter Chan, who's probably one of the most successful directors working in China as a producer and director out there today. He's actually born in Thailand, I believe, but he's directed this film. It's a drama about a couple that lost their child and then tracks it down in a village and takes it back. And then the foster mother, who presumably didn't know it was stolen, goes to try to get the child back from them. And it's based on a true story.
Wow.
So yeah, so it's a interesting film. Everybody in China apparently knows the story. It was, you know, big headlines. Now it's a film, and it started off very strongly in one market, which is China. At number five is Lucy, the Luc Besson film. That's just about to pass $400 million worldwide. Then there's Guardians of the Galaxy right below it. That's about to hit $650 million worldwide. At number seven is another movie that's in only North America. That's the comedy drama, This Is Where I Leave You. Another $7 million. That's at $22 million and counting. How is that doing, really? Cost $20 million to make. It's made $20 million so far. When all is said and done, they'll probably break even, but not really tearing it up.
No, and I don't think this movie was meant to tear it up, do you?
Isn't every movie meant to make money?
Well, yeah, okay, true. I mean, even if you're spending $20 million to make the movie, if you make $100 million...
they're not expecting $300 million, but, right. At number eight is the Liam Neeson film Walk Among the Tombstones. This probably will not launch the series. It's one of his lesser performing action films of recent years. It grossed $6 million this weekend. It's at $30 million worldwide.
You know why? Because he didn't talk into a phone and threaten somebody over the phone.
That always helps. You.
Yeah.
At nine is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That's at $350 million. Cameron Diaz is right below that with Sex Tape. And then we jump down to number 12 just so we can say it. No Good Deed is at about $50 million in North America. And it stars, of course, Idris Elba.
Oh, I didn't think we'd get to Idris Elba on this episode.
And one other movie in the top 20 worldwide. I love the name of this movie. It's a Chinese animated film, a soft opening, $2.7 million. I mean, I don't know how many screens it's on, but it sounds soft to me. It's called Big Head Son and Small Head Dad. The movie.
That sounds like a hilarious movie.
I saw some stills. I wasn't able to find the trailer yet, but I saw some stills and it looks very kiddie family oriented, but I just love the name. I think you should star in Big Head Son and Small Head Dad. Not that I'm saying your head is small.
Well, both Big Head Son and Small Head Dad and Dearest are obviously doing quite well in China, but one film that I don't think is doing quite well, in fact, it's not even being shown in China, is this Nicolas Cage film, Outcast. So technically, that film is an outcast in China.
That's right. It's a Chinese co-production. They did everything to make sure this movie would be released in China and be a hit. It stars Nicolas Cage, Hayden Christensen. What are the elements of the movie? I forget what the plot is now, but it's got some Chinese elements to it. It's not like they just shot there. It's set partially in China. That's my understanding. But anyway, it's an action. No?
There's Chinese cast members.
Yeah. Like, they did everything. And now it's just about to open, and then they pulled it. And nobody knows why.
Well, but there's some, you know, there's some speculation that the reason is there's a big national holiday.
But that's not a surprise.
No,
so,
exactly. No, it isn't a surprise.
Why it would suddenly be pulled at the last second when it's not a surprise that, you know, whatever holiday is coming up is coming up.
Yeah. And this is happening again and again where it's the rules change as the game is being played. It's like watching children play. And one person, one of the kids, just starts making up rules as they go along. It's like nothing's written down.
That makes it sound very childish. I think it's more about different elements, perhaps, of this government fighting for power and control. Who wants to decide what movies get played? Hey, you think you get to make things happen? I'm going to show you. You don't have all the power. So let's not make it sound like, you know, little willfully, you know, it's different people fighting for power. It's not necessarily just somebody changing their mind willy-nilly like a little child. It's the bureaucracy of this part of the government arguing with the bureaucracy of that part of the government over who has control over what films get shown in China. Let's face it, there's a lot of money to be made. And so if you're a gatekeeper, there's probably a lot of, I'm making this up now, I have no reason to suspect or charge this, but you're a gatekeeper, you can block a film getting made, guess what? You're going to make money. People are going to slip you money. You got power. Suddenly your corruption payoff is going to be a lot bigger. That could be part of it. Could be just a simple trying to show this is your territory. Don't tell me what I'm going to release or not release. Somebody, you know, there's a lot of reasons for it. Let's not make it sound, you know, just, you know, maniacal and crazy. There's, you know, it's people in a government all searching for ways to assert their authority and make money.
Right. And ways to prevent that are write down your rules and then stick to them, as opposed to there are no written rules. And therefore, we get to call the shot as we see it whenever we want to and change them as we go and move along, which is what's going on right now.
That's why companies like to do business in the U.S., because there's not the history of bribery. There's not the tradition of bribes that there is in other countries. And it's not just China. It's Italy and lots of countries in the world where you've got to bribe officials and get people just to get things done. It's the way things are done and always have been. And if you want to step to the world plate, you got to change it. You know, you're going to have a better economy in the long term. But it's not, you know, willy-nilly. It's not just sort of random silliness just to do it like a spoiled child. It's people fighting for power, and it's a big pie, and it's getting bigger all the time because the Chinese market's exploding.
All of those things could also be said about Russia, don't you think?
Absolutely. That's a big market. It's growing in importance, and there's certainly corruption there and bribery and things. You want to get things done, sometimes you got to grease some palms. Well, that's illegal for North American companies. You're not allowed to do that overseas. We don't care what the tradition is.
A couple years ago, the SEC was poking around because of they were looking into the studio's transactions in China, actually, just because they thought there was some bribery going on, which is not allowed, as you just pointed out.
That's right. And so tensions are tight between Russia and the U.S. There's a lot of political turmoil right now.
I would say tensions are tight between Russia and, like, everybody else in the world.
You know, some of the people in the world, others are their friends. But anyway, the U.S. is leading economic sanctions against Russia for its illegal annexation of parts of the Ukraine. And they're having a big impact. The country's stock market is hurt. Currency is hurt. Billionaires are losing money, and they don't like that. And they're starting to complain a little bit. So there's a little pushback, perhaps, against Putin. Though the people closest to him are very rich because he's in power. Anyway, because of that boycott, Russia's looking at a way to strike back. Where do they look at? Movies.
Yes, they go, not arms, not the military.
Well, the
let's ban their movies.
Well, I'd rather have an economic war than a military war, number one. And number two, Hollywood is a huge export industry, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's actually one of the number one exports of the United States, if I'm not mistaken.
One of the biggest. Yes, yeah. Some military arms would be number one, but...
Right, well, yeah.
There you go. But I think that's true. But anyway, they're the sixth largest movie market in the world. They made gross $1.3 billion in 2013. Hollywood accounts for more than 75% of that. That means that's about $300 million flowing back to Hollywood from Russia. And what's happening?
Well, I guess they are going to stop releasing movies in that country.
That's what they're threatening.
That's what they're threatening, yes. I don't think they've actually done it yet, but certainly The Hollywood Reporter is saying that Russia is mulling over the idea of boycotting Hollywood movies over the sanctions that you know, the U.S. and others have placed on Russia.
And so, of course, that makes Hollywood studios nervous. They go to their congressmen, their senators, say, hey, do we have to be so mean to Russia? So it's, you know, it creates tension for everybody. There's not a lot Hollywood can do about it.
No.
Right? You don't want to be pro, you know, empire and say, oh, let them take a couple countries. So it's a really a lose-lose situation.
Well, what they could do is the MPAA could go to Congress to basically, I think Russia is a part of the World Trade Organization. If they're not, they could try and fight
it. They certainly are, yeah.
Yeah, they can try and fight it through legislative means, but certainly not through, you know, asking to...
Fight what? You mean Russia's actions?
Yes, correct.
I'm talking about them putting pressure on the U.S. about their boycott.
Oh, okay.
Of course, they can't do anything about Russia's. You know, what are they going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah, they could have more penalties. Of course, they could place, you know, through international organizations like the WTO.
Right.
But again, it's an ugly situation. But of course, Hollywood studios have, you know, co-productions and things they do in Russia and things they do in Japan, and things they do in China. When you're punishing them, you're punishing yourself in a lot of cases. Right. This Chinese U.S. co-production with Nicolas Cage, that's not a pure American play. There's some Chinese company that's getting hurt by that release boycott.
That's
or
right.
Or not boycott, by that release delay, because they've spent the money on advertising. So this inter-country fight is hurting somebody. So, you know, these things happen. I mean, look at DreamWorks, right? They may be owned in part or in whole by a Japanese company.
That's right. Actually, over the weekend, The Hollywood Reporter, we were just talking about them regarding the Russian boycott, but The Hollywood Reporter got a scoop that DreamWorks Animation is for sale, and it appears that SoftBank, a Japanese conglomerate, has made an offer to buy DreamWorks Animation for $3.4 billion.
Now, the stock is trading at $26. That's up on the news of the possible deal.
Yeah, but on Friday, it was trading at $22, which would have meant that the offer to buy them, because it had a market cap of $1.9 billion, that is, DreamWorks Animation had a market cap of $1.9 billion. That means the offer to buy was a 45% premium.
Well, the stock always goes up once you announce it.
Oh, absolutely.
And the offer of $32 per share is lower than the 52-week high of DreamWorks Animation. So they're at a sort of an unnatural low. I think they're slightly devalued more than they should be. We just need one or two big movies, and then suddenly the stock will shoot up again. But yes, they're offering more than they're trading at right now, less than the 52-week high. I don't think they're paying an extraordinary premium for the company. I think it's a very reasonable offer, you know, based on a very broad look at the company. But number one, I never heard of SoftBank. And number two, Variety said, hey, hold on, this may not happen. They quoted some insider at SoftBank saying, nah, we're just kicking the tires.
Due diligence. You got to do your due diligence.
Well, right. So the big question is, well, what are you buying? And one, in part, you're buying Jeffrey Katzenberg. He is 63 years old. He's about to turn 64. But part of the details of the potential deal were that Jeffrey Katzenberg would sign on for another 5 years. He is the heart and soul of DreamWorks Animation, and you wouldn't want to lose him, especially during the transition.
Right. And quite honestly, you would also, I mean, at that point, he'd be 68. He might be thinking of retiring. And so if he doesn't want to retire...
Who retires at 68?
I'm just saying, if he doesn't want to retire at 68, hey, you have the option of keeping him around.
Of course. But just saying, you're not buying the company and not having Jeffrey Katzenberg on board.
Right. Well, and you know, quite honestly, the reason that the LA Times had an article saying that, oh, this sale may actually save DreamWorks Animation. They had two quarters of losses this year alone. And their movies, Mr. Peabody and Sherman, grossed $273 million worldwide, which kind of underperformed. How to Train Your Dragon 2 was more successful, but not, you know, pulled in $611 million, but they thought it would do better. There was your favorite movie of all time, Turbo, which unfortunately you still haven't eaten a snail because it did hit $300 million. No, it never hit $300 million, did it?
No, that's why it didn't hit a snail.
That's right. So, you know, they've had some releases that just didn't work. And you're right. It's all about the release pattern for them. They are a smaller company. They release 2 to 3 films a year. And they really have 2 to 3 at-bats, unlike a Warner Brothers or 20th Century Fox, where they're up to bat 12 to 20 times. And if one movie completely tanks, hopefully they've got another one right around the corner that's going to do, you know, twice as much or 3 times as much as the loss.
Right. But when you're in an animated studio, you can't turn out more than 2 movies a year. You know, you're really going to hurt your quality if you do. And by the way, no escargot was harmed during the making of this show.
Well, and you said, Michael, that notice how I just kind of overlooked that escargot comment. But you said you didn't know about SoftBank. I've known about SoftBank for, I would say, since 1999. They invested, I want to say, and I'm going from memory here, I can't remember the name of the company. I want to say it was called Real Play or Real Player. They invested.
Oh, I remember Real Player. Yeah.
Yeah. Not the R-E-A-L. It was R-E-E-L. So it was kind of like a movie marketplace where for professionals.
That was the stock market thing for movie bets?
No, that was Hollywood Stock Exchange.
Okay. Anyway.
The fact that I remember any of this.
So they've been a player in Hollywood for a while. They invested in, they made a deal with Apple very early on, a couple years before the iPhone came out. They secured the rights to release the iPhone
actually,
in Japan.
Actually, that's an interesting story. But really, that story... And this type of investment is all based on SoftBank's, and I don't know why they have the name bank in their you know name, the word bank in their.
Because
they're
not a bank.
They're not a bank. They are a venture capital firm, and they are run by the CEO Masayoshi Son, AKA,
or as we call him, Masa.
Masa is his nickname. He is 57 years old. He went to high school in the U.S. He went to college in the U.S. He's kind of seen as this guy, this executive who works more in the U.S. tradition, more so than Japanese executives. He's kind of seen as a maverick, and he seems to be somewhat fearless. He lost a lot of money in the dot-com boom in the late 90s, early 2000s. In fact, I think I was reading in the Hollywood Reporter that he lost $75 billion during that.
Well, that's nice. So he's only worth $50 billion. So why does he want to buy DreamWorks Animation?
He wants to buy DreamWorks Animation because he owns Vodafone, which, by the way, just to finish off your story, he met with Steve Jobs in 2005 to convince Jobs to give him the iPhone, exclusive rights to distribute the iPhone. There's a couple problems there. One, there was no iPhone, okay? So he was actually betting in the iPhone 2 years before it was even announced. And two, he didn't have, and this is Masa, he didn't have a carrier. So Steve Jobs said, yes, you can have the iPhone exclusively, but you have to figure out the carrier beforehand. So he went and he bought Vodafone, and he bought it for $15.6 billion at the time in 2006. Everybody thought he was crazy. Why would he do such a stupid thing? Well, because he knew that the iPhone was coming, and he was betting that the iPhone would be enough to carry that company, and it was. It's one of the largest carriers, if not the largest carrier in... Docomo, I think, is the largest carrier it's one of the largest carriers in Japan.
All right, so he owns a phone company. Why does he want to buy DreamWorks Animation?
Well, there's a lot of synergies. He also owns game companies and SoftBank.
Why does he want to own DreamWorks Animation? It's not a game company. It's not a phone service.
He needs content. Content is king.
For what? Not for phones, not for games.
Well, he needs content. He's got 1,300 companies. SoftBank is invested in 1,300 companies, and he's looking for synergies, ways to not only diversify in Japan, because when you have 1,300 companies, you're not really looking to diversify, but he, I think, also wants to get into China. He already is in China with Alibaba. During that big dot-com...
He's one of the players investors in Alibaba, the Chinese company.
Right. Just to give you some sense of this guy, he's really interesting. He invested $20 million in Alibaba back in 2000. $20 million. When it went public last week or last month, $50 billion is what that $20 million turned into.
I wonder if Masa would like to invest in a startup book company, a book website called BookFilter. But anyway. Okay, so he's got his fingers in a lot of pies. He wants to start owning content. He doesn't own any other content particularly right now. I mean, Alibaba he owns. I guess that's content.
That's more retail.
Right. So this is his first foray, perhaps, at least in the West, into content?
Yes. I will say no, because he did try to buy...
Yes, except no.
because I'm remembering he made an offer, an $8.5 billion bid, which was $2 billion more than the company was worth, to buy the Universal Music Group, an offer that was declined. They said no.
Well, so he hasn't... he hasn't invested yet in software, in content.
Yes. So this
making an offer is and not being accepted.
Well, foray was the word. So I was.
Well, he hasn't done it yet. So this may be his first acquisition in content.
Right. And
at least in the West.
And if you think, wow, SoftBank, where have I heard that name before? It was probably because last year SoftBank bought Sprint, a North American mobile carrier, for $21.6 billion.
He bought Sprint in synergy with Vodafone. That makes sense to me.
Exactly.
All right. Okay. Well, so I guess it's a big deal that he's making this play. Do you think it will happen?
I don't know. I think that for Jeffrey Katzenberg, who should see it as a win, actually, because it will give
Give him an out, get him to cash out, and he gets to stay in charge.
He gets to stay in charge. It gives him far more resources to play around with, and financially specifically. And I know that
assuming they want to invest a ton of money in content.
Yes, correct. Now, I know that Jeffrey Katzenberg at one point notoriously said, hey, I think that if we sell, we should sell for as much money as Pixar sold for, which everybody laughed at, and thus he was unable to sell the company until now SoftBank comes around, and it's obviously not the $7 billion that Pixar sold for, it's $3.4 billion, but still.
Given the number of films they've released, probably in the box office, it's probably the same valuation in a way.
Yeah, I agree.
You know?
I think it's probably going to happen. I think that DreamWorks Animation probably needs somebody to come along with some cash and some synergistic valuation.
I don't think it's synergistic if they don't have any movie theaters, they don't have any DVD or Blu-ray things. What's the synergy?
Well, television, number one. DreamWorks is getting heavily into TV. So
does SoftBank own a lot of TV stations, or
not TV stations, but they're, you know, Vodafone, basically mobile video, which is where everything is going. They also own Yahoo Japan, or at least a stake in Yahoo Japan. Mm-hmm. And so there's some
Word synergy is just so silly. I hate to hear it unless there's a particular play that's in, you know.
What about synergistic?
I mean, Disney has synergy when you've got theme parks and cruises and movies and a TV channel. Then yes, Star Wars has synergy, and they sell toys, and they have theme park rides, and they have cruises, and they have TV shows, and they have movies, and they're all based on the same product. That's pretty clear synergy to me. You own a phone company and you're buying an animation studio, that doesn't yell out synergy to me.
Well, what about the word synergistic? Because I think I may have just made that up a minute or two ago.
I liked it.
Okay.
I think it's a big deal that you've just crafted a new word.
Ah, okay. So then in that case, it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, you gotta love this one since we just talked about it last week. We talked about the scourge of drones hovering over top secret movie sets like Star Wars, the new Star Wars that's in production. Think of the safety and privacy issues that raises. Now it turns out Hollywood would love to have drones flying over their movie sets, just as long as they're the ones piloting them. The FAA announced an exemption that allows studios to use drones in their work without the need for a licensed pilot, certified aircraft, and FAA approval. Restrictions likely include needing a closed set and a three-person team, including the drone operator. Studios had banded together to make the request. Drones with cameras have been used overseas on shoots like Skyfall, Expendables 3, and Game of Thrones. What I can say is, get ready for a glut of superfluous, non-diegetic aerial shots. Is this
non-diegetic?
Non-diegetic. That means
what a film school choice of words.
That's right. That's exactly where I learned that word. In
that means
film
you're
school.
Not getting the point of view of a bird in flight. You're just giving a shot that no character in the movie could possibly have.
Yes, correct. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, but not for Hollywood.
What?
Well, because I say this because everybody wants to use drones. And the fact that they gave this exemption to Hollywood has every other business in America knocking on their door saying, we want an exemption too. Apparently, our skies are going to be filled with drones.
Well, if you read the FAA kind of announcement, it is very restrictive. It's only six companies, and
but it's opening the door.
Yes.
That was the headline in the New York Times said, it starts with Hollywood. It's not going to end with anybody because everybody wants drones. I don't know why, but they do.
Well, and it might start with all of these really, you know, lots of restrictions, but then slowly those restrictions get kind of chopped away over time. And all of a sudden it's, drone operator, maybe only one operator. You don't need three guys there. You don't need to have certain precautions in place. But, you know, that's the way I'm sure other.
Maybe you need one kid in Taiwan on a screen, you know, like Vegas, they're doing the drones in Afghanistan. Why can't you have a kid in Taiwan? Why does he have to be on the set?
Yeah. You know what? Why do you need a director? Why not just get a drone to direct your movie? Well, I'm sure, actually, when you think about it, I'm sure some people think drones are directing some of these movies.
And why have an author? Why get authors to put together a book?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's Stephen Fry. You know, he's an author, and he's an actor, and he just loves technology. He's been an ardent and fascinated promoter of the possibilities of the digital world, becoming an early and enthusiastic Twitterer, if that's a word, touting the gay social app Grindr, on, of all places, a TV car show named Top Gear. He's done audiobooks and generally championed technology for years, so it makes sense that Fry would be game for experimenting with the form of books. His new memoir, More Fool Me, or More Fool Me, has been opened up for what his publisher Penguin is calling remixing. Fry's earlier book, Fry Chronicles, spun off a highly acclaimed app. Instead of just doing that again, Fry is ready to see what other people can do. So Penguin UK is releasing huge chunks of the new and previously, I guess, unreleased memoir, offering them up under headings like theater, childhood, gay rights, and so on. People are encouraged to do anything and everything with the stuff, mashing them up, repurposing them, you name it. A panel headed by Fry will give awards to the most innovative, and it should, all in all, be great fun. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Oh, why? After all that?
Okay. Well, what do you think?
It's a big whoop.
Right. This is fun. It's clever. I bet people will do really cool stuff with it. I love Stephen Fry. He's had a multiple memoirs and autobiographical novels that are kind of memoirs in disguise. So the previous memoir was not unreleased. He's had a number. They're just putting out a bunch of stuff and saying, play with it. Do with it what you will. And it'll be fun to see what happens, but don't get tricked into thinking, oh, this is the new future of books. No, it's not. It's just a fun little thing that you can do. And it doesn't really apply to most book projects.
I have the title of his next book, though, already. What? Do you want fries with that?
Oh, God.
No? Okay. Well, it is official, by the way, Michael. True Detective is a phenomenon. The HBO series made such a big impact that simply announcing who would star in season 2 was big news. That would be Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn, by the way, two well-known talents who, just like Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, are overdue for a critical and commercial hit. They will certainly get a lot of attention. Creator Nick Pizzolatto, I don't know how do you pronounce his name.
I don't know either. I know it's Idris Elba.
Okay, well, Mr. Pizzolatto will write all 8 episodes, but director Justin Lin will only helm the first 2. So Justin Lin, you might recall, he is Fast and Furious director. He's done a
That's right.
And
last
of those.
Season, one director directed all 8 episodes. So they're not going to have one director throughout the entire show. But again, it's TV where the director is not king. Apologies to all the talented directors who work in television. But, you know, it's really the showrunner and the writers who define a show traditionally.
There's also a female detective to cast, most likely Rachel McAdams. Now, who has talent and needs a boost? Let's think about that. Big deal or big whoop, Mike?
It's a big whoop. Actor gets role. Hello, Karen Woodward. Shout out to Karen Woodward, our old co-host. I think the pattern of these people and who got picked was interesting, but I don't know if Rachel McAdams fits it. She's clearly very much in the running. She's a fine actress, but she doesn't seem to be like the pattern we had in season 1, people who really kind of needed a boost and sort of been around. I was thinking more like Laura Dern or Deborah Winger, but, you know. It's a strong cast. People are going to be excited for the new season. We'll have to see what happens.
It's not the biggest franchise or the biggest property, but the stage musical version of The Lion King is the single biggest hit in entertainment history. More people have paid more money to see The Lion King on stage than any other musical, play, movie, or rock band on tour. To be exact, The Lion King has grossed $6.2 billion so far, passing The Phantom of the Opera at $6 billion. Both are still playing on Broadway, though The Lion King is quote-unquote younger, if you really want to get technical.
By a lot, yeah.
By a lot, and still the highest grossing show on Broadway, taking in double what Phantom is making these days. Much more money comes from overseas, tours and sit-downs in Vegas and the like. In contrast, the highest grossing film of all time is Avatar, with a measly $2.8 billion. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, it just tells you how much money you can rake in on Broadway. And this is, of course, the outlier. This is the crazy extreme example. But, you know, you get a 2-3-4 year run, makes you one of the biggest hits of all time. But that's still, there's a lot of money to be made on Broadway. That's why so many movies and books and TV shows are being turned into Broadway hits, or, you know, Broadway potential hits, I should say. It's a big source of money.
Thom Yorke's surprise new solo album is already up on BitTorrent. And you know what? He doesn't mind. The site was famous for peer-to-peer technology that let people steal digital copies of albums, movies, and TV shows. But now York is partnering with BitTorrent. He released a surprise new solo album through the company, making it available for $6 via what is called a Paygate Torrent. That's the first time that technology is being used in BitTorrent history, at least. Once York covers the transaction costs of people downloading the item, BitTorrent will get 10% and York will get the rest. The album is also available on vinyl, although obviously not through BitTorrent. That would be interesting.
That'd be crazy.
Yeah. Radiohead, which is currently recording a new album, by the way, made headlines when they released their album a couple years ago, like I think at this point 5 or 6 years ago, and they made it available for free and asked fans to just pay what they wanted. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You know, it's an offshoot solo album. I think it was a bigger deal when Radiohead released In Rainbows that way and said, hey, pay us what you want. But it's a cool experiment. See how the BitTorrent community reacts to it. You know, you want to get people used to paying. You want to make it as easy as possible for them to pay. I mean, I know people who live in other countries like Spain and elsewhere, and they pay for TV shows, but they don't want to wait 2 years or 6 months or 11 months to see the show. And so they just take them. Because yes. They don't have the choice of paying for them. So you know what? You got to make it as easy as possible for people to pay. Go where they are. Make it simple. Maybe you'll get them. And, you know, $6 for a digital copy. People go, well, that's fair, you know?
Yeah. Even if you were just like, you know what? I'll skip a latte today and I'll listen to the Thom Yorke album. Of course, now we're going to
Or they buy the Thom Yorke album and steal the latte.
Yeah, well, I don't know how you would do that, but I'm sure...
Well, exactly. That's the whole point. People are happy to steal intellectual property. They're happy to steal your movie or your book or your album. Ah, it's a big company. But they, you know, they obviously don't think they have the right to walk into a store and steal groceries or steal clothes. But for some reason, they think, you know, it's not really stealing. So the New York Times had a funny story about the unrepentant bootlegger, this young woman who was on a website that was, you know, stealing stuff. And she was like, well, I didn't think it was stealing, really, or it wasn't that big a deal. Well, you know, she spent like 6 months in jail and still hasn't learned her lesson. But, you know, there's a whole history of people not paying and not thinking they need to pay. Of course, we're getting to the world where you don't pay. All you do is pay for access to a huge library. And that's, I guess, the way we're going.
Well, and before we get email with people telling us that indeed a latte should not cost $6.
I agree, but it's very easy to get up to 4 or 5.
Exactly. Now, okay, so the movie Deadpool, a spinoff from X-Men, is finally getting a release date. Fox will release the movie in February of 2016, perhaps with Ryan Reynolds to star since he played Deadpool in Wolverine back in 2009. That led to some other announced changes. Assassin's Creed, the potential franchise based on a video game, was set for summer of 2015, but that's in a holding pattern now, since I don't think they've even started filming that yet. So that opens up a slot for the Fantastic Four reboot, and that move opens up an earlier slot for Paper Towns, the drama based on the novel by John Green, who counts as a franchise in his own right, I think, as an author. Have you got all that, Michael?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. Oh. And the reason we brought it up, because it's like a week or two old, this news, is to just say, hey, these people are picking release dates 5 years in advance. It's a little silly, but they do it. Don't get uptight when they change the release dates. It doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean the movie's in trouble. Doesn't mean they're not down, whatever. I mean, sometimes it means something, but most of the time, just relax. When you're picking a release date for a movie that doesn't even have a script yet, you can't get all tightly wound when they drop it or put it out, whatever. You know, we're just looking basically at their wish list of movies, and
really,
you know, some of them don't work out.
All they are doing is marking off dates so that other studios stay away from them.
Right, but you know, if your movie starts to falter, someone can say, you know what, I'm going to go on that date. And suddenly you say, yeah, okay, to be honest, we're really not releasing a movie that day.
Right.
Oh, well.
We've been talking about South Korea as a hotbed of creativity and box office success for a while now. The U.S. networks know this as well. ABC has just snapped up a red-hot South Korean romantic comedy TV show for remake purposes. My Love is the name of it. It's a drama about an alien who has been living on Earth for years, but unlike Superman, has sworn off getting involved in human affairs. I can't believe somebody is writing my biography. Well, this is until his annoying...
You got mild-mannered down pat, by the way.
Exactly. Annoying but somehow appealing female neighbor, a self-centered movie star, because don't we all have self-centered movie stars as our neighbors?
You do.
Yeah, well, that's true, actually. Well, she's about to be murdered, so the alien among us must come out and save her, I guess. The show has been a massive hit in South Korea and China. This, of course, happens all the time. A&E is remaking a Mexican drama called Niño Santo about a faith healer that leads a cult, yet might actually be the real deal. Big deal or big whoop?
I think there were there's another one. There's a USA Network is adapting Telemundo's hugely popular telenovela Queen of the South. Now, that ran for 1 year because that's what telenovelas do. It's based on the novel by Arturo Perez Reverte about a woman whose drug-dealing boyfriend is murdered, and then she goes on the run and starts the plot to take revenge on the big crime lord who killed him, and then, of course, as one would, take over the cartel herself. I like to call it Breaking Bandita. But, you know, it was the biggest hit in Telemundo history. That's being turned into a TV show. This has been going on for decades. But I really, you know, I remember All in the Family. That was a British TV show turned into an American one. American shows get turned into foreign shows, foreign, international shows, you know, local editions in France and Germany and Spain. It's happening, I think, though, more and more. Don't you think so? I feel like, you know, people are paying attention to hits all over the world. Is that game show working? Is that reality show working? Is that drama working? Should we just bring it here or should we remake it?
Well, and it's happening more and more with reality shows, in fact.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They've been doing that since the beginning. I mean, the first reality shows were just copies of foreign ones. I think Survivor was based on something else, right? That wasn't an original.
Yes,
Big Brother and Survivor were both, you know, copies of hits that had happened overseas. So I'm just waiting for the slow movement. You know, when are we going to get that TV show where they, like, put a camera in the train window and watch the train travel across America for, like, 7 days, and people just turn on the channel and get to watch that happen?
Hold on. I'm writing that down. That's a great idea.
We talked about that.
Oh, we did?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were doing it like Norway or something, or Sweden. They like have shows where people knit. They start knitting a sweater and they just keep the camera running until the sweater is done, like 8 hours later. And there's the slow movement where you a train ride or just a camera out at the fields watching, you know, a lake, and they just show it and people turn it on and watch it. So that's coming to America too. That's some cable channel is going to do that. So I just feel like TV is really a worldwide phenomenon now. There's no single country anymore. Everybody is interconnected to everyone else. I wish more of these shows would come here in their original form though as well. I mean, I'm sure ABC wants to.
I would bet that they will be in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I want to see My Love. It sounds silly fun.
The publishing giant Penguin Random House wants a bigger place at the table when it comes to turning their books into movies. So the company has signed a first look deal with Universal. The two companies already have the beginning of a beautiful relationship. Big movies tied into Penguin Random House books include Angelina Jolie's World War II drama Unbroken and the Valentine's Day release 50 Shades of Grey. I wonder what that book's about. Their previous agreement was technically with Focus Features, not Universal, even though Focus Features is owned by Universal. Now the entire Universal team is on board and looking to make new projects happen by plundering the company's vast backlist and new releases. This will actually require Hollywood executives to read. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
No, it requires Hollywood executives' assistance to read. It's a big whoop, but I think it could hurt them, but it won't. So here we go. There are 11 books in the top 25 bestsellers on one ebook chart. This is from Digital Book World that are all linked to big movies. Books like Gone Girl, entries in the Maze Runner series, Outlander, which has been turned into a TV show, The Fault in Our Stars, and so on. I glanced at the Amazon charts when we were doing this, the notes, and 9 of the top 25 titles there had tie-ins to movies and TV shows. So obviously, it's a huge source of material for movies and TV and all that. However, with more and more authors having the ability to go solo and not have to sign with a big publisher, and there's huge and advantageous reasons to sign with a big publisher, one thing you don't want to do is hand over your movie rights. So I'm not sure what deal they're making with new offers, but if you're saying that, gee, I'm going to get a lower royalty rate than I will if I go on my own, and now they're going to tell me you don't have the rights to your own book anymore, we're going to take that or take most of it, and we've already got a deal in place with Universal, well, I'm not happy about that.
Okay, well, let's clear up a few things. It's a first-look deal, okay? So here's what that means. Universal pays a little bit. They may pay nothing, by the way, but usually they pay a little bit of money to the rights holders, in this case, Penguin Random House, for the exclusive of having Penguin Random House say, here's our new book. You're the first to look at it. You have the right of first refusal. If you pass on this, then we can take it anywhere else we want. And, you know, we, along with the author, can take it anywhere else we want and go make a movie there.
But I'm the author. I'm not giving them my rights at all.
It's not a right. No. And neither.
I'm not giving Penguin Random House any play in my book rights. If it's a potential movie, tough. You're not getting my movie rights.
Well, that's all in the contract.
I'm not signing that off. I know how a first look deal works. And I'm telling Random House, you don't own the rights to my movie. Sorry, I'm not working with you if you think you're going to have a cut of my movie deal.
Well, I think that depends on the contract. But it's the contract between...
It depends on the contract. Yeah. I'm a new author, and I'm deciding, do I want to sign with Penguin Random House? Or do I want to sign with Simon & Schuster? Or do I want to go solo? Well, number one, if I'm writing the type of book that's going to get turned into a movie, the first thing I'm going to say is, well, you're not getting my movie rights. Thank you. I'm glad you think you should have them because you're publishing my book. But I say, no, you're lucky if I get a good movie deal because then the book is worth a lot more, isn't it? So don't tell me you're not only do you get to see the book powered up the charts because there's a big feature film made, but you also get a cut of the money I make for turning it into a movie. No,
I wonder what I wonder what the norm is these days. Like, in other words, there are certain clauses and certain rights that are held back by authors traditionally, and there's no controversy over it, or there's no conflict over it. I wonder.
Well, that's definitely a conflict because they all realize, oh, there's money to be made. We look stupid being left on the outside. We're a big conglomerate. We've got contacts and deals. We want to be a part of that. You know, there's big money there. Look at the bestseller list. It's filled with books turned into movies and TV shows. You're a new author. You don't have any power. You're going to be lucky to, you know, once you have a hit, then your next book, you can have more say in what happens. But your first book or your first book until you get a big hit, you know, you don't have a lot of power, but you have more when you decide to go solo.
Well,
there's a lot of advantages to being with a publisher.
Well, and when it comes to these contracts, there are certain clauses that are kind of like you expect them to be there. For instance, with actors, it's, well, you can expect that there will be a sequel clause in your contract and no studio will sign a contract with an actor's or actor unless that clause is there, even if there's no way in hell they're ever going to make a sequel to a specific movie like The Fault in Our Stars.
Right, but you negotiate and say, well, I want to make this money more, that money more, that money more. You know, if it hits a certain level, I make more money.
Yes.
You get more leverage with them. But authors traditionally have had very little leverage, and I think they have more now because of self-publishing. Though, again, it's a shot in the dark, and it's not easy to get attention for a book, and you're really partnering with someone that can bring a lot of attention to your title. You know, going solo, that's nice. You got all the rights to something no one will ever read. I understand how that is clearly the option for 99.9% of people. You know, it's very hard to get attention even with Random Penguin backing you up.
Yes.
So I understand that. But nonetheless, you know, in this day and age, to think you're just going to be able to sign off all the rights to all your writers and have a first look deal with one studio, I don't think that's a very good advantage for your authors.
Needless to say, after our interview last week with Mark Berman of TV Media Insights, we were eager to see something, anything, reporting on TV ratings that included DVR usage, not just overnight snapshots. So it was good to see The Hollywood Reporter had a feature talking about DVR usage and which shows got the biggest boost. Unfortunately, the story was filled with a lot of hype and very little data. They said that the quote-unquote winner, and I'm putting that in quotes, the winner of the DVR race was Gotham, which jumped 56% in the key demo of viewers aged 18 to 49. Sleepy Hollow jumped 50%. The Blacklist jumped 44%. And Forever jumped 41%, to name a few shows. But exactly how many people watched these shows? Yeah, here's the thing. We have no idea. It was a relief to go across the pond and hear some real numbers about British TV watching. In the battle of the monster hit Strictly Come Dancing versus Simon Cowell's return on The X Factor, the dancers were winning with 8.1 million viewers versus Factor's 7.85 million. On the other hand, Factor was up versus last season, while Dancing was down, and Cowell did beat Doctor Who, which aired opposite Factor, and later than ever in history, reaching 4.89 million viewers. But wait! Is that total viewers or just overnights? We don't know, actually. And if all of this has confused you, welcome to the entertainment industry. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I think this is crazy. There has to be advertisers who have info on all TV shows, right? Cable channels, network shows. They've got to release real figures to these people because they're paying the money, right?
Yes, but so, not overnight and not... Not
overnight, but I'm saying 2 weeks later, the advertisers must know how many total people, Live Plus 3, Live Plus 7, watched all shows on every cable channel and every network in prime time, if not 24 hours a day. They've got to have those figures.
Well, the media buyers certainly do because you have to know whether there's a make good on something or not.
Right, so I figure buying that information from Nielsen is probably just too expensive for TV Media Insights. I think the cost must be exorbitant or they would do it.
Well,
somebody should be leaking this information to people in the media so that we can actually report on it. Somebody should be handing over to Mark Berman of TV Media Insights or us. Give us the info on all the TV shows, not just the networks, but cable. I'd love to know the prime time for the entire week, live plus seven. I'd like to just know how many millions of people watch this show, that show, and the other show. I'd love to see a list of every show that was a hit. So somebody has these numbers. They should be releasing it to Mark Berman or us, somebody somewhere, so we can actually see the actual list of how shows are doing.
Well, that concludes our list this week of Big Deal, Big Whoop stories and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Why don't you ask me about the first one, and then I'll ask you about the second.
Okay, well, we have two stories here. So, as you know, because Michael just said so, there are two lawsuits in the news. One was settled and thus will never have the impact it would have if the Supreme Court weighed in on it. The other is moving through the courts and could still be a significant case. Michael, the first one is this Jack Kirby versus Marvel Comics versus... What is all this about? I remember we talked about it in the past.
This is Jack Kirby. He was a player at Marvel and then DC, a hugely talented figure in the comic book industry.
Didn't he create Spider-Man with Stan Lee?
He worked with Stan Lee on, I believe, Fantastic Four, the X-Men, the Incredible Hulk. He did stuff on his own. He was created and co-created lots of stuff. A big player, huge talent. Never quite got the press that Stan Lee did, but that has changed in recent years. He's a wonderful talent, and his estate has decided, well, okay, he didn't get all the attention during his lifetime. Let's get some money now. And they have been suing everyone in sight, suing everybody for all the movies, all the TV shows, all the money being made off characters that he helped create. And they're insisting we've got the rights to that. We deserve a piece of the pie. Marvel says, no, no, no. He was a work for hire. It wasn't his work. We paid him to do that for us, and we own the rights to it. And here's proof. And this case has been winding its way through the courts. Obviously, it has a lot of implications for Hollywood, because these movies make a ton of money.
Right.
But more importantly, if it had gone to the Supreme Court and they decided to review it and they had weighed in, it could help clear up work for hire and who's actually an employee and who's not an employee. And what happens when you create something creative on your own for somebody? Like, do they own it? Do you own it? Because they force you to sign off on it and insist it's theirs. But is that legal? Just because someone makes you sign a piece of paper just to get a job doesn't mean you've given up your rights. Always, you know, sometimes you can't give up rights. Other times they can say, no, that's coercive, and you didn't give them up. It's very complicated and specific to this case, because he was a guy who worked at home. He bought his own materials and he turned it in. But then they paid him and said, sign this form, prove to us that this is ours and not yours. And he did. So there's specifics to the Jack Kirby case. But then it does have big implications, because no company wants employees anymore. Everybody's a work for hire. Everybody's freelance. So who owns what? There's got to be, you know, ramifications when you've got creative people writing stuff, creating stuff, drawing stuff, and they're doing it for other companies, companies that don't want to pay them pensions, don't want to pay them health plans, but they do want to take the work and insist you have no right to it. So this case was being watched highly by a lot of people. Everybody was eager to see what might happen, but it fell apart and they made a deal, and now it's not going to go to the Supreme Court. So like so many cases in Hollywood, the big companies, I think, blink a little bit. They get a little scared and say, you know what? We don't want to take this to court. And they say, let's make a deal now. It'll be cheaper in the long term. Let's get this to go away. And that's what happened here.
And I wonder if this case will actually be a part of the new course at the University of Baltimore called Media Genres, Media Marvels. It's all about the Marvel movies.
Is it a business a class, or is it a creative class? Or
I think it's a business, and I don't know. That's a good question. The teacher, Arnold Blumberg, said, one thing we'll do is dive into the impact of the Guardians of the Galaxy film, which proved two things. Mainstream movie audiences are not remotely tired of superhero movies, and Marvel Studios can now release a sci-fi adventure that actually features talking trees and raccoons.
Well, audiences are never tired of any genre. Westerns, musicals, you name it. Make a good one, people will come. But that's sort of interesting. But you see that a lot in colleges. They use a current pop phenomenon to explore more substantial issues.
Well, wasn't there like a course in Lady Gaga a couple years back?
I think that was just, you know, after school credit for the course in Madonna.
Ah, okay. Well, the second court case is one we've also been talking about for a while, and a ruling came down. So this is actually still in the process of, well, still still in the court, going through the court here in the U.S., right?
Mm-hmm. That was a California judge who weighed in, right?
Right. And that's kind of important because it's a California judge and this is a copyright case. And the federal copyright has this whole pre-1972 sound recording rule where you don't have to pay for performance rights, i.e. airing them or broadcasting a song.
Now you can play an old Beatles song. You can play an old song by the Turtles. You can play an old song by Creedence. If it was recorded during before 1972, it costs you less money to play it on the air.
If not, nothing. Mm-hmm. So Flo and Eddie of the Turtles, they actually won. They were suing SiriusXM. It's the satellite radio provider here in the United States. And, you know, basically the plaintiffs were seeking about $100 million in damages. And last Monday, there was a ruling that a lot of industry insiders, they're looking at this as this could actually disrupt the operations of not only satellite radio, but also of streaming internet radio providers.
Right, because they already claim the streaming companies like Pandora and others claim, oh, we have to pay too much as it is. But now they're worried about a much bigger price tag coming up down the road.
Right. And so SiriusXM, which, as we pointed out at the top of the show, will more than likely appeal the ruling. You know, this is a problem with the 1995 copyright law. It had this kind of...
It was sort of a compromise, right? They said, all right, we're not going to worry about stuff before 72, but from 72 on, this is what we're going to do.
Correct. Yes.
And nobody's happy about it.
Nobody.
How could these two guys even have a stake in this?
Well, because they got all of the rights back. They got all of their rights.
Publishing or masters?
Obviously publishing.
Oh, I was setting you up. I thought they got their masters back.
Yes. Oh, they did. They own their masters. Hey, sorry.
When you play a song on the radio, publishers make money. Doesn't matter when it was written. You're still going to, I think for most songs, you're still going to have to pay off the songwriters and others. But there's also rights that have to be done for people who own the actual recording itself. Now, I don't mean the artist who sang on it or played on it necessarily, but I mean the people who own the masters. So there's money to be paid there as well. That's what I think what we're talking about here.
Actually, so, given that it's a performance, you know, we're basically talking about the performance copyright, it would have to be masters.
Right. So the Flo and Eddie of the Turtles at one point in their career regained the rights to their masters. Ray Charles was the genius who never gave up his masters. When he made a big deal and signed off after leaving Atlantic, he said, I want to own my own masters. That's kind of like that's the way to go forward. Prince fought for many years to get his masters back. That's why his new albums are just about to come out with Warner Brothers after, you know, a decade long estrangement because he wanted to own his masters. Otherwise, he felt like he was a slave and they were the master. So, you know, this is all happening because artists got power and were able to claw back the rights to their own music. And that's the sort of the theme of the show this week, I think. Whether you're a writer giving away movie rights or you're a studio that's got, you know, rights in this company and that company overseas to try and make things happen, or you're an artist or you're a satellite company, you know, who has the rights to what you're doing? You know, who controls creatively what's going on?
Yeah, I think that, you know, part of the issue here is that there is a federal copyright law in the United States. And so Flo and Eddie sued in California, and they're going by a California copyright law.
Well, that's what you do, right? You try to find the
loophole,
the jurisdiction that is most favorable to you. Not a loophole, which implies some sort of nefarious trick, but you know, you find the favorable jurisdiction in which to file your case. It might be New York, it might be California, it might be Delaware.
Right, but it's a California law. So
that's right. Well, that's why they.
So think about it this way, and we talked about this actually on a previous episode, where if copyright was went down to the state level, it would be a nightmare. It's going to be a nightmare of patchwork. You have the rights here, you don't have the rights there. This copyright law overrules that copyright law, and so what this is saying is, guess what? You're going to have to start facing this nightmare because this particular ruling is on the state level.
Well, yes, but it will go through the federal courts, I believe, won't it?
Yes.
At some point. And also, of course, let's keep in mind that there's a reason some laws originate in certain states. You may have laws about cattle that originate in Texas. California and New York may be the states where a lot of copyright law comes into play that will, ipso facto, have effect throughout the rest of the country because everybody else will just follow suit. There's not a lot of copyright going on in, you know, Oklahoma as far as movies and music are concerned. So I think that's perhaps why these laws originate in certain states and then apply nationally just because other states follow suit.
Now, I'm going to read something from, I guess it's the Hollywood Reporter. It says, a whopping ruling with consequences almost impossible. to overstate. So I would agree with that.
All right. Well, we'll have to see what happens.
Well, I can tell you what will happen if you email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We may read your email right here.
Cool.
During this segment of our show. Now, that's exactly what Scott T. did. Do you want to read it, Michael, or do you want me to read it?
I'll be happy to.
Okay.
Michael N. Sperling, a couple episodes ago, I can't remember which one or how many, you were arguing over whether U2 was paid by Apple for the exclusive right to give away their most recent album. That's Songs of Innocence, I believe.
Yes.
As someone with years of experience in the music industry, I can tell you the answer is a resounding yes. U2 is now managed by Guy Osiri, who also handles acts like Madonna. He took over from Paul McGuinness, who was the band's manager from the start. Even though deal points haven't been made public, there seems to be consensus in the industry that Apple paid a flat fee of some amount, about $20 million, for exclusivity and are considering an iTunes marketing line item. I beg your pardon. And are considering that an iTunes marketing item. That means they, you know, they consider paying for the album of from U2 a marketing item for iTunes.
Right.
You know, that's how they put it under their tax purposes. At the same time, Apple agreed to feature a song off U2's new album in an ad campaign for their new iPhones and watches with a campaign spend of $100 million. This is sometimes referred to, at least by me, as an upfront in-kind deal. Some of the money comes in advance with the addition of non-paid guaranteed marketing services that help promote the band. Keep up all the good work you do in each week's show. Scott T., music attorney from New York.
And I would say it's not only helping promote the band, those marketing services, it's usually kind of a dual marketing campaign where it's, hey, here's our new product and here's the band or the movie or the another product that you should know about being used by the first product. So yeah, it's kind of a in-kind services.
Right. We were looking at their album. Their last album sold 5 million copies worldwide. So we figured that was maybe roughly $40 million in gross that they might have left on the table by releasing it for free, as we imagine might be the case. So if they got $20 million for it, or $15 or $18 million, that's a pretty good deal. You know, they got it to more people than they ever would before in history. It's accessible to more people than any album in history. Thriller can't even begin to match the 500 million people that could now download and listen to Songs of Innocence. That can really help their tour. They got money for it. Plus, they got the big push for the band and the album and the tour that will surely follow. So it's a good deal for everybody.
And you know what's a good deal for you?
What?
Our show, because it's free.
Oh, my God. Free is the new free.
That's what, you know what? I'm going to make a Netflix. I'm going to call Netflix and see if we can get a show on their service called Free is the New Free. Or no, they already have one like that, don't they?
Well, keep going.
Okay, yeah, that was a really bad joke. Things that also, by the way, Michael, for free.
Yeah.
Just like our show, which you can subscribe to in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, where they aggregate podcasts, list podcasts, you can usually find our show. If you go to one of these aggregators and we're not there, let us know. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us, 888-567-SAND. Again, that's 888-567-7263. I already told you about ways to subscribe to the show. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where we are at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information, the ways to subscribe, the ways to follow and like, and the ways to contact us can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, showbizsandbox.com is the website. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website every single week. It's different. Where can we find you this week, Michael?
This week you can find me at It's Not the Ego, It's the id.com.
Ooh, a callback from the beginning of the show. You know, if you have a problem finding any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry,
talk to your superego. That's what I say.
Oh, yeah. Or, well, you try michaelgiltz.com. You can run on over to thehuffingtonpost.com to find it. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.